Fielder has won his second All-Star Home Run Derby. He's only the second player to win the contest more than once. His childhood hero, Ken Griffey Jr., won it three times, and Fielder recalls frequently spending time as a kid at Griffey's home.
He always took care of me when I was a kid, so, you know, to be mentioned with him is real special.
Prince Fielder outslugged Toronto's Jose Bautista to win the Home Run Derby, hitting 28 homers during three rounds. And the Army is getting out of NASCAR racing. It says it's reallocating its marketing budget. The Army's been sponsoring Stuart Haas Racing. Its decision comes as two members of Congress push legislation that would prohibit military sponsorship of sports. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from USA Network, presenting Political Animals, starring Sigourney Weaver, Kieran Hines, and Ellen Burstyn. Premieres Sunday at 10, 9 Central.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
On this program, on this station, in the media, on a regular basis, you hear stories about how bad things are around the world. In this part of the show, we will be talking with the co-author of a new book that makes a different kind of argument that really argues that the world is getting better, and it's getting better at a rapid rate. Our guest is Stephen Kotler. He is a best-selling author and award-winning journalist, writes a lot about issues of science and technology. He is the co-author of a newly published book. The title of the book is Abundance, and the subtitle is The Future is Better Than You Think. The Free Press is the publisher. His co-author on the book, by the way, is Peter Diamandis. He is the chairman and CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation and co-founder and chairman of Singularity University, also co-founder of International Space University. And in the book, they cite a number of statistics, things like, for example, increases in global standards of living, increases in food supply, higher rates of literacy, higher rates of life expectancy, the fact that infant mortality has declined significantly. And overall, they make the argument that we are living in a better world than people, you know, maybe even a century ago. And the book also argues that things will continue to get better and talks about the forces that are responsible. And Stephen Kotler, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. Well, I was attracted to the book right away, and I must admit it is because it's the argument that it makes is different from that we have presented that we often hear. I'm sure that when you do interviews and when you talk about this, that a lot of people will say, well, look, we have a lot of really serious problems, many of them having to do with two big issues like consumption of resources and production of waste, just to name two things. And we have a lot of other problems beside. And I'm sure people say to you, how can you talk about things being good and getting better when there seems to be an awful lot of evidence to the contrary?
Well, first of all, there is a tremendous amount of evidence to the contrary. And I think, you know, we have been done a disservice lately in that there have been, you know, a number of, not perhaps in the past decade, but there were a lot of techno-utopianist tomes that said technology alone will get this job done. And clearly that's not the case. It hasn't been the case. And I think it turned a lot of people off. There's, you know, there's also, and we spend a lot of time in this in the book, and we can talk further about this if you'd like. Our brain is hardwired not to see a lot of the progress that's going on and not to see a lot of the positive that's going on for various reasons. So we kind of break that down to kind of help us solve people's cynicisms. But, you know, ultimately we stand by our thesis that, you know, the present is a lot better than most people suspect. And because of the power of, you know, four emerging forces, we now have the power to significantly raise global standards of living over the next 20 to 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly it's hard to argue that standards of living are better today than they were, let us say, 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. I think that you might have trouble convincing people that there has been progress maybe since the end of World War II.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, all right?
Okay.
I mean, and you are right. On the grand scale, for example, violence has dropped 100-fold since the Middle Ages. But let's talk about the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
20th century alone, child mortality fell by 99%, excuse me, by 90%, maternal mortality by 99%. Income adjusted for inflation has tripled. Longevity has doubled. Food is 13 times cheaper than it was at the start of the century. Electricity is 20-fold cheaper. Transportation is 100-fold cheaper. Telecom is 1,000-fold cheaper. In fact, when we talk about abundance, people say, well, can we have an example? We say, well, if you are a Maasai warrior in Kenya on a cell phone, you have better access to information and to communication technology than the President of the United States did 25 years ago. If you're on a cell phone with access to on a smartphone with access to Google, you have better access to information than the President of the United States did 15 years ago. That's Clinton. That's astounding. That is absolutely a tipping point towards a world of information communication abundance. So we're already kind of seeing these changes. And to speak directly to your point, post-World War II, in the past 50 years, global standards of living, poverty has dropped more in the past 50 years than it has in the previous 500.
Mm.
So the present is significantly better than most people assume. And, you know, if you really want to go back 100 years ago, you got to think about the fact that most people in America today living below the poverty line have access to a car, a cell phone, a telephone, electricity, running water, flushing toilets, and a whole bunch of other things that the richest people on Earth couldn't even have imagined 100 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, I want to belabor this point, but I guess one thing that certainly will concern people is that it seems that not only that wages have been stagnant now, here at least in the United States since the 70s. But I think the thing that concerns people more and more is income inequality and the fact that the wealthiest people have so much more than the people at the other end, and that I think that they might make this argument, and I'm not exactly sure that it's true, that in fact that income inequality in the world is actually worse than almost it's ever been.
Well, the metrics are really peculiar because when you start talking about, first of all, that is not true. And the easiest way I can explain this is Hans Rosling, who is a kind of very famous scientist from the Sweden's Karolinska Institute, did a very famous TED presentation where he had been basically running around the UN databases for years and years and years, and he was looking at things like the gap between rich and poor, and he developed a very interesting way of visualizing this data so everybody can see it. So you can literally watch his TED talk and, you know, in full graphic presentation, you can watch over the past 100 years the gap between rich and poor shrink almost across the boards. Mm-hmm. So it's not true. I mean, on that one, it's just not true. It doesn't fit the data.
Okay. Well, let me ask go back to one of the points that you made, and essentially here in the book that you and your co-author really argue that there are four important kinds of forces, trends, whatever you want to talk about that are really at work here. And you really touched on one of them, and that is information technology that gives us access to gives a lot of people very wide access to a lot of information, have the ability to communicate that they haven't before. And particularly it's been dramatic in the developing world where they didn't have to string a lot of copper wire because of the advent of the cell phone. So they jumped over that intermediate step, and now that's the way that people are communicating, and that for a relatively small amount of money, it puts a device in your hand that has tremendous computing power. So that's certainly been an engine of growth already. You think it's going to be
even more so? That actually, so what you're talking about falls into a category that we call exponentially growing technology.
Mm.
A lot of people are familiar with the term from Moore's Law. In 1965, Gordon Moore, who founded Intel or went on to found Intel after this, discovered that the number of computer chips on an integrated circuit had been doubling since the invention of the computer chip. And he predicted that this doubling was going to continue for 10 more years. Now, a doubling is exponential growth. It means every year your computer gets twice as fast for the same price, essentially. So constant for 10 years, then 10 more, and all told, it stayed constant for 50 years. And researchers have since figured out that these exponential growth curves now underpin all information-based technology. So this, you know, explains why the cell phone in your pocket is 1,000 times cheaper and 1,000,000 times more powerful than a supercomputer from the 70s, but it also is starting to show up in fields like robotics, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, cloud computing, 3D printing, and on and on and on. These are all technologies that give us massive, massive, massive amounts of leverage when we go after kind of the world's grand challenges. So that's the first and kind of probably the most important substrate. And what people, the speed that this is happening is so fast. And when you think about Moore's Law, you think, oh, my God, that is, you know, that's incredibly fast. But it's nothing compared to biotechnology. Biotechnology is now advancing across the board at 5 times the pace of Moore's Law. So these are massively exponential effects, and they get bigger as you go farther up the curve. So on a lot of these cases, you know, people, we're just starting to see the change now, right? Information communication technology is where it started to show up, and as you pointed out, Africa absolutely skipped a generation in landlines. So let's talk about where this exponential technology is going to give us leverage in healthcare, for example. Right now, let's go back to Africa. Huge problem in parts of Africa is getting, you know, there aren't enough doctors, there aren't enough hospitals, people can't afford it, and diagnostics are a real problem, really big issue. But right now, my co-author, for example, Peter Diamandis, and his XPRIZE Foundation, they just launched the Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE. Now, the tricorder may sound familiar to you. It's the Star Trek scanning technology that Bones used to kind of wave in front of you and determine what illness you have. Mm-hmm. Well, the goal of the XPRIZE Qualcomm Tricorder is to blend microfluidics, lab-on-a-chip technology with cloud computing with AI-based diagnostics. And so what does this mean in real life, and what does this look like, and why am I talking about it? It means you're going to have a device in your cell phone where you spit on it, put a drop of blood on it, or a drop of urine, and it analyzes this data. It screens it for major illnesses. It then takes this information, it uploads it to the cloud using cloud computing. And a couple years ago, you may remember that there was a computer that IBM built called Watson. It beat a human competitor on Jeopardy. The big deal with Watson is Watson could understand natural language. That was what the point was on Jeopardy. Jeopardy, they speak in slang and colloquialisms and all this other stuff. So for a computer to beat a human, he had to understand kind of natural speech patterns. So suddenly you can put blood, sputum, or spit, or urine on the cell phone device. It goes up into the cloud, and you can talk to your cell phone and have a conversation with it. And Watson, after he got done beating people on Jeopardy, got sent to medical school. So right now they are programming Watson with as much diagnostic information as possible, essentially trying to create a computer that can diagnose illness better than board-certified doctors. When you blend all three of these things together, suddenly you are solving diagnostic problems across the third world. So it doesn't just mean, oh, we're getting better access to communication and information. It also means it's a healthier population who's getting access to this information and communication. Well, and you start getting really, really, really incredible network effects that way.
Well, I'm sure when confronted with that example, that a lot of people will right away say, well, that's great, but if you can do a diagnosis like that, you can collect body fluids, and then your phone will say to you, congratulations, you have liver cancer. Now, there's a big difference between having a diagnosis and having access to treatment.
Okay, so in answering that question, let's talk about our second category, our second force for abundance, which we call the DIY innovator, the do-it-yourself innovator. And today, for the very first time in history, the DIY innovator, solitary groups of people or lone individuals even, can take on the kinds of grand challenges that 10 to 15 years ago were the sole province of large corporations or governments. There are lots of different examples I can give you. The most obvious one is the first initial XPRIZE, which was a private race to get into space. It was the first person who could build a private spaceship that could get into space twice in 2 weeks, a reusable spacecraft, which is something that every aerospace contractor in the world and NASA said was impossible. And the few people who did say it was possible said it was going to take billions of dollars because NASA spent $300 billion trying to do the same thing. The XPRIZE was won in a very short time frame by Bert Rattan, a solitary engineer working with a group of 20 guys in essentially an oversized garage in the Mojave for $26 million. Now, that was back, you know, a little bit farther back. That was kind of, you know, space is one of these things that nobody before could touch. And suddenly we've got it, you know, it's being hacked by, you know, kind of DIY innovators. Now, you would say, well, $26 million is still a ton of money, and you'd be correct. So let's jump forward to where we are today with DIY innovators. Chris Anderson, who's the editor-in-chief of Wired, has five kids, and he's kind of a geek dad. And a couple of years ago, Chris was playing with around with a Lego Mindstorm robot and a quadcopter, kind of autonomous helicopter, and with his kids. And the robot turned out to bore the kids, and the helicopter crashed immediately. But Chris kind of got curious, and he was like, what happens if I take the controller from the Lego Mindstorm robot, kind of the low-grade AI system, and use it to try to fly the quadcopter so maybe it won't crash into trees? And he didn't know anything about this stuff, so he started an online community called DIY Drones to try to do this. Within a very short time, it had 37,000 members, and they were making a lot of progress. So they set themselves a goal. The cheapest drone on the market, military drone on the market, is the Raven. Mm-hmm. It costs $35,000, $250,000 for the entire system. So this online group of hackers, basically, working for free in their spare time in 1 year, built an autonomous drone that has 90% of the functionality of the Raven for $300. And they're now trying to lower that cost to $100. So what's the big deal, and how does this get back to your question about how do we, you know, treat the liver cancer, the AIDS, or whatnot?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things, you might say, well, this is a hobbyist pursuit. Great, they've got a $100 quadcopter, neat, what does it do for me? Well, right now there is a Singularity University spin-off company called Matternet that is combining these quadcopters with solar-powered autonomous charging stations throughout roadless Africa, and you can now get your diagnosis via cell phone, and in the next couple of years, let's say AIDS medication is a really big issue in Africa. How do you keep people on a regimen that requires daily drugs in a country, in a part of the world where one-third of the roads wash out for half of the year? What do you do, right? Well, you can now place your order via smartphone. The quadcopter goes to the hospital. It picks up your meds, and it brings them to you. So we are starting, the exponential technology is starting to surround some of these problems. I'm not saying we have all the answers at all, but we have significantly more leverage than people can even begin to anticipate.
All right. Our guest in this hour of focus is Stephen Kotler. He's a best-selling author and award-winning journalist. His work has appeared in New York Times Magazine, Wired, Discover, Popular Science, GQ, Outside. He's the co-author, along with Peter Diamandis, who is the chairman and CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation. They're the co-authors of the book Abundance. The subtitle is The Future is Better Than You Think, and it's published by Free Press. We have a caller here. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Callers in Piatone, line 4, the toll free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. This is interesting. I love this topic. I was talking, the topic of discussion actually with this morning was about, just happened to be about Bert Rattan, in fact. I grew up out there. Actually, I was born and raised in Lancaster, California, which is two towns south of there. But I know my neighbor used to work for Bert Rattan. I grew up, he's a very smart gentleman. In fact, his brother, same thing, very smart. But here's the problem with America. It seems like we're lazy. All these technologies you're throwing out there, they're great, but who's inventing them? There's other companies and other around the world that are inventing them. What's coming from America? You know, people like Bert Rattan and others in this America, they're trying to make it. Now, the only downfall is this is one of those adventures where only rich people can play around in. Okay, and it's kind of sad. And it's a known fact, somebody brought this out not too long ago on TV, where our engineers and our scientists, we're lacking. There's less and less people getting into the mathematics end of stuff and going other places because, why? Easier money. And I think that's the problem. It's, I think we've gotten fat on our laurels. I think everybody is trying to figure out the easiest way to make a buck. And, you know, all this stuff is great. And David brought this up earlier, where everybody's income has gone, you know, they're lacking of. I mean, I figure we're at 1980s levels. And I think we've gone back a little bit in history in mankind. We still haven't figured out a decent way to make the combustion engine run better. You know, and I know it's a work in progress. It's probably going to take decades before we figure out anything. But it seems like we're at a critical point in this country. Somebody's got to do something. The inventions aren't being like made like they used to at the amount. I mean, I think the turn of, the 20th century, where all the engineering stuff was happening, all the, you know, the Iron Age, the trains, the cars, everything being invented, I think you'll never see that again. I think it's going to be a slow, drawn-out process. I'm just curious what you think.
The call raises a number of points that could keep us going for a while. You want to pick a few things?
I'm trying to pick one. I'm going to do two very quickly.
Okay.
So one I want to talk about, because it dovetails really nicely off the Chris Anderson story, and it's the question of, you know, wage stagnation versus, you know, and resources and things along those lines. One of the things that Chris Anderson talks about, when you talk about how do you basically, like, do this for so much cheaper, he talks about dematerialization, which is, it's actually Bill Joy's term. And what it basically means is that technology tends to dematerialize a lot of kind of necessities. So we made a chart in the back of Abundance where we go through everything that, you know, a wealthy person in the 80s would probably own: a very fancy watch, a nice stereo, a home video system, and on, this big long list. Every one of those things now comes standard in your smartphone. All this stuff has dematerialized. So a lot of the stuff that we used to need a lot more money for, we are now being able to get, we are getting, you know, it's just coming bundled and things. So that trend is going on, and it is going to continue going on, and these same kind of effects are going to keep going in the way that we're seeing diagnostic technology kind of dematerialize into your cell phone and on and on and on. So that's one point that I want to bring up. The rate of innovation is a really interesting topic, and, you know, my co-author Peter Diamandis is great on this. We absolutely agree with you. We need to step on the gas on the rate of innovation. There are two things that we think, or maybe three things, that are going to make a big difference here. The first thing that we have to talk about is another of our forces driving forward, which is what we call the techno-philanthropist. Right now, in the past kind of 30 years, more wealth has been created than ever before in history. And most of it was created by young entrepreneurs who reinvented whole industries before the age of 35, right? And then they turned their attention to so-called grand challenges. So unlike the kind of robber barons of old, who most of their charity was very local and it was focused on kind of putting their names on buildings, that kind of stuff, today's techno-philanthropists are interested in taking on grand challenges. So you have Bill Gates crusading against malaria and crusading for vaccines. Jeff Skoll is fighting against pandemics, fighting against nuclear proliferation. This list goes on and on and on. And another key difference with today's techno-philanthropists is it's no longer I write the check and I'm done. It's I write the check and I'm just getting started. So they bring their whole networks and their talents and their ideas and everything else, lot more leverage. So what does this have to do with the common man? One point is that there is now more money available, whether you want to DIY it and crowdsource it through Kickstarter, Crowdfunder, Crowdrise, all these online sites that are, you know, setting records. Kickstarter keeps breaking its own records. Nobody raised over $1 million, and now it's over $1.5 million, and it keeps going. So there's massive amount of access to capital through these kind of online cooperative tools. There's also a massive amount of impact investing. So when we started writing Abundance a couple years ago, the number on impact investing in America was $50 million. This is people investing their money in triple bottom line companies that go after grand challenges that help us move forward. That number, according to a recent report, I think it's by McKinsey, I could be wrong, is going to jump to $1 trillion by 2020. That's a massive amount of money coming in to fund innovation. So the next question is, how do you drive it forward? And one of the things that we argue for more than anything else is the use of incentive prizes. This is what Peter helped kind of pioneer. Incentive prizes go back, you know, way a very, very long time. Longitude was solved because the English Crown put up a longitude prize. There's a long history of this. Charles Lindbergh flew over the Atlantic and kick-started the aerospace industry to win the Ortigue Prize, which was put up by a hotelier who wanted to stimulate kind of the travel industry. Peter got massive amounts of leverage with the X Prize. He put up a $10 million prize. People did over $100 million worth of research, and you only have to pay the winner, right? You pay the guy who solves it, so it gives you massive amounts of leverage, and it also gives you kind of like these very strange network effects where people who are not, you know, major aerospace contractors jump in and get involved and come out on top. And we see, you know, the Wendy Schmidt oil cleanup challenge was done in, created by Peter in response to the oil spill in the Gulf. And, you know, Wendy Schmidt wanted to create, find a prize for ways to get oil off the surface of the ocean faster. There had been zero progress, literally, since the Exxon Valdez spill to the present day, none whatsoever. Industry couldn't get the job done. Nobody could do it. The goal with the X Prize was you had to, I want to say it was double the rate of oil cleanup off the surface of the ocean, maybe triple it. Seven teams, I think 120 teams entered. Seven teams solved the problem. I think it was solved within 6 months. So this is the kind of leverage you get from incentive prizes. And this is also, by the way, you know, one, very, very difficult for governments to keep up with the rate of change, which is another, you know, issue here. But the Obama administration has adopted incentive prizes. Every aspect of government now is utilizing incentive prizes to drive innovation forward. So there is a long way to go, and I agree with you. And I, you know, I could talk about the education question if you want, but I'm going to shut up now, and maybe we can take another caller.
Well, yeah, we do in fact have some callers. We're talking this morning in this hour, a focus with science writer Stephen Kotler. He is the co-author of the book Abundance: The Future Is Better Than You Think. So we have some callers here. One who has been pretty patient here, so we'll get back to the phones and we'll talk with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello. Call there. There we go. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we got you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm listening with so much interest to what you're saying, especially in regards to what technology can help, how technology can help solve health problems in Africa. But I think what is missing in the solution you are proffering is the people of Africa itself.
Oh, it's like, by the way, I have to jump in because you're so right, and I didn't mention that point earlier, and I really want to talk about it because I'll let you continue, but I just wanted to say I totally agree with you, and it did get cut out of the discussion.
Yeah, what I'm looking at, for example, you talk about the copter drone that can deliver medication when roads are impassable. All that seems fine until you realize that sometimes the solutions designed in North America, taken on the ground in Africa, actually fails to take off. I'll give you one example of the U.S. Marines or Special Forces who are helping hunt down Joseph Kony, this rebel leader in the equatorial forests. All the technology which these troops have taken with them is failing to work. So they have had to fall back onto doing it the old-fashioned way, really hunting, slogging it over, you know, forests and crossing rivers.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really great point.
Yeah.
And the greatest apocryphal story I heard along that's kind of more direct on our lines is it was I can't remember where in Africa it was. It was a pipe extension project in a village where the women had to walk 4 hours every other day in both directions to get water. And somebody came in and they ran a pipe within a quarter mile of the village and thought it would solve the water problems, and people kept hacking the pipe. and nobody could figure out what was going on. And when they finally went in and had a conversation with the women in the village, the women said, look, these 4 hours every other day are the only time we get away from the men. They control our lives, and we don't want to give up our walking. Nobody bothered to have that conversation ahead of time, so a tremendous amount of money was wasted. Now, to address this point, I want to talk about our fourth force in abundance. And the fourth force we call the rising billion, which are the so-called bottom billion right now, the poorest of the poor. And why they are rising and what's going on, it's a two-stage process. The first stage kind of started over the past 20 years, really kicked off with a book by C.K. Prahalad called A Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, and it was about people figuring out ways to do business at the bottom of the pyramid. And every single lesson has the same central point, and it was the reason aid failed so severely for 30 years. All this stuff has to be co-creative. You have to work with the people you're helping. Otherwise, it's absolutely a wasted effort. Otherwise, you end up, you know, flying tractors into the middle of Africa and having no system in place to bring them replacement parts. So even though tractors could really help a lot of people, you know, we dumped millions of them, and they became hood ornaments and other things like that because nobody could fix them. So, you know, one of the reasons the bottom of the pyramid is starting to rise is because businesses are more and more figuring out how to do business at the bottom of the pyramid. And the other thing that is happening is the rise of communication and information technology that is really, really, really starting to drive this forward. So the reason we talk about the rising billion as a force is right now, today, there are 3 billion people online out of 7 billion possible. By 2020, that number jumps to 5 billion. The vast majority of these people are coming out of the lowest rungs of society. These are people who have never been part of the global conversation before. We've never had access to them as a marketplace or as an idea factory. As a marketplace, they represent tens of trillions of dollars of capital coming into the economy, the global economy, annually. That's a massive amount of money, first of all. Second of all, they represent a massive amount of creative potential. And their ideas are really, really interesting. And what makes this more exciting is we talked about earlier some of the advances in healthcare technology. So not only are people coming online, they're going to be healthier. There are really astounding, you know, radically new educational systems that are debuting all over the place online. The really simple example is the Khan Academy, which was, you know, basically online tutorial videos started by a guy named Salman Khan, who was just trying to make instructional videos for his nieces who were studying in school. The videos caught on, they became popular, and they now have, I think it's over 2,200, might be significantly higher by now, videos online. You can essentially go kindergarten through first year, second year of college online for free, and right now Google is translating what is, you know, in English now into 7 major languages, and then the Khan Academy wants to crowdsource them into every other language. So what this means is pretty soon, no matter where you are in the world, as long as you have a smartphone, you have access to educational materials, really, really powerful educational materials. So you're talking about these people are coming online. They are going to be better networked, they are going to be healthier, and they are going to be better educated.
I just want to get back to the caller here. Is the guest addressing the point that you wanted to make?
Yes, he is. Except I would want to add also there is the language end of the equation. And I just before I called, I was trying to pay my water bill on the phone. And there is this other artificial intelligence computer, whatever, asking me questions, can't understand my accent. And
yeah, you are not wrong. I mean, we have been in this country for 14 years. The good news about the breakthrough with IBM and Watson,
everybody who you are going to help in Africa will be able to speak English to understand, there will be the barrier of accent.
And, you know, a lot of that is, you know, when they got Watson to understand natural language and went on Jeopardy, that was a very big step in that direction. The good news about this is an artificial intelligence problem, and artificial intelligence is an information-based technology, so it is on an exponential growth curve. So, yes, you are not wrong. It's a big problem. But the good news is that the technology needed to solve it is, you know, getting massively more powerful every year.
Well, I want to thank the caller, and we're coming into the point here. We have about 12 or 13 minutes left. I hope he will forgive me for going on because we have some other people here. I'd also like to get in, and so we will go to the next in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I have many reactions to this, but I wanted to point out that mixing the analysis description that you're doing of the situation in the world and then implying that the prescriptions such as, you know, competitions for Head Start, they've even introduced funding, is, I think, and I think the Billionaires Boys Club of the Diane Ramvich, a critic of criticism of the current educational competition systems, is really, really relevant here. But it's away from what I originally was calling about, which was the way statistics can cover things. Now, my understanding is that this increase in income around the world can be attributed to a single country, and that's China, and pulling them out of pulling many people into a higher income level. So that's why there are less people in the world today earning less than $2 than there were some years ago. At the same time, there's an increase in inequality in China, and there's an increase in insecurity, which, you know, you can't tally up the same way you can tally up a statistics. They no longer have a guaranteed income, which, you know, you can criticize that as a communist thing, but it is something that has actually, in some ways, for many of the migrant workers of China, which there are more than there are people in some countries, has really contributed to a lot of uncertainty and deterioration of their living in some ways. So there's all of that. I just think this is, I'm allergic to this Panglossian kind of best of all possible worlds kind of thing. And the point I wanted to leave on, which is there's also a more visionary thing to look at, which is not looking at the world and how these indicators are changing and stuff, but looking at the world of technology and what we should expect to be happening. And I think if you start thinking about that there's no reason why there are any starving people in the world right now, and there are. And so I just think that there's a tendency for this to be lead to some kind of resignation in the current system, and I think that's entirely inappropriate, and it may be beyond the scope of your book, but it seems like I just wanted to point out that if you look at what might be possible compared to what current technology is doing for the world as it is right now, we come up woefully short, it seems to me.
Well, I agree with you wholeheartedly. You have to look at India, by the way. If you want to look at income disparity, you can't not talk about India. It's not just China. Though China and India, you know, do have a very significant balloon effect here, but it is a lot more global than you would suspect. And I would take a deep look at Hans Rosling's talk. A lot of people have been over it with very fine tooth combs, myself included, and a lot of us are very, very comfortable with his analysis. That's besides the point. Your second point is fantastic, and I want to speak to it, which is. I'm taking offense at the use of the Panglossian word, because we are not saying this is automatic. We are saying, and we are very, very clear in the book to outline the problem space very, very thoroughly. We, you know, give you massive amounts. There's 130 pages, I believe, of reference materials, footnotes, and charts to back it all up so you can see exactly what we're talking about. So we're working from kind of the best sources we possibly can to outline the problem space, and we are not saying this is automatic. What we are saying is the initial conditions are such right now. Technology, as you pointed out, is advancing so rapidly that we have massive amounts of leverage and more and more every day and more abilities to cooperate, and we are going to have to cooperate together like never before. to create a world of abundance, it's the, you know, it's the biggest DIY cooperative project in history, but it is now possible, and that's what we're saying. So we agree with you completely. The fixes are not in, but you can combine these technologies in such a way to get so much leverage with when coupled to these three emerging forces that you really can produce magnificent change in the world.
Let me introduce again the guest for anybody who has tuned in the last little bit. We're talking with Stephen Kotler. He's a best-selling author, award-winning journalist. He is the co-author, along with Peter Diamandis, who is chairman and CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation. The two of them are the authors of the book Abundance. The subtitle is The Future is Better Than You Think. It is published by Free Press. You can take a look at it now. It's out and available. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, let me ask you something else. It seems that often in these kind of discussions, what we end up talking about is improvements in people's material standard of living. And I guess I would include things like access to food and better health care and education, in a sense, as part of that. But the question that's often raised is, as you talk about rising standards of living around the world, particularly when you're talking about the vast numbers of people in the developing world who have a long way to go to meet to get anything close of the standard of living of people in the industrialized world, what we come to is some really serious questions about resource consumption and waste production, including the cost and waste associated with producing energy, and whether the planet can, in fact, bear this kind of increase in people's material standards. Is this something that you look at in the book?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the current calculations are if everybody wants to live like a North American, we're going to need five times the world's resources to pull it off, right? Now, that there's a lot wrong with that calculation. It's very kind of back of the napkin-ish, but conceptually it's not wrong. But we have to talk about a couple of things. We have to talk about what technology really does. And this is the book, for those who haven't seen it, it appears to be wrapped in aluminum foil. And there's a reason. We open the book with the story of aluminum. And in the early 1800s and to the middle 1800s, aluminum was the scarcest metal on Earth, which is why the Washington Monument is capped in aluminum. It was more expensive than platinum. It was more expensive than gold. There's this great story about Napoleon III throwing a huge banquet for the King of Siam, where the King of Siam got aluminum utensils, Napoleon got gold, and everybody else had to make do with silver. It was very, very, very valuable. What's interesting about aluminum is it's literally one-eighth of the weight of the world. It's everywhere. What it isn't is ever found free in nature. So it's always found bound up in oxides and silicates. Over, you know, a 30, 40-year period, essentially the technology of electrolysis is discovered, and suddenly one of the scarcest resource on Earth becomes one of the most abundant. And it's so abundant that today we use it with a throwaway mindset. So the point here is, in a lot of circumstances, technology is a resource-liberating mechanism. Where this comes into play, for example, water is a great example. We have a giant water crisis. You know, the UN predicts water wars by 2025. These are big issues. But we live on a watery planet. Three-quarters of the Earth is water. The problem is that most of it is salt water. So once a new technology like electrolysis comes along that can turn salt water into fresh water, suddenly technology becomes a resource-liberating mechanism. Something that was once scarce becomes now abundant. So there are other questions, like what do we do with rare earth metals and things like that? And those get peculiar, but you have to have a really deep discussion about synthetic biology and what's now possible in biology and the fact that we're learning to basically grow resources from scratch. These things are all coming, and, you know, they are very interesting with resource scarcity. But let's jump to your second topic, because it's really critical and it's really important, which is waste. Mm-hmm. And there is, both in water and in energy, there is so much waste in the system. It's incredible. We have, you know, massive food issues, and yet 50% of everything, maybe 70% of everything, I think it's 50 though, that we produce spoils because we just can't get it there in time, things along those lines. So what's great about a lot of the technology that's coming in food and energy is that it's all and water is that it's all linked in smart grid technologies. So the systems itself are getting much smarter. So we have pipes that can detect leaks, and we're also creating pipes that are self-sealing. So it's going to take a long time to get this infrastructure up to speed. I mean, we've got wooden pipes underneath Boston and New York and Philadelphia. Some of the system is really, really old, and it's going to take a while to get there, but we are moving in that direction, and the upside is significant.
And you just, I'm still sort of thinking about the problem of access and need to for fresh water, and the fact that we know now how to take the salt out of seawater. It's just really energy intensive.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different things I could talk about here. I'm going to talk about, and this is a fine place for us to end, I'm going to talk about Dean Kamen and the slingshot. So Dean Kamen is one of the great kind of maverick DIY inventors in history. And everybody knows him from the Segway, but that is just, I think it's one out of nearly 400 different things he's invented. Most of his energy goes into medical technology. A bunch of years ago, he was working on dialysis. And one of the biggest problems with dialysis is people have to inject a tremendous amount of water into their systems. Trucks have to back up at people's houses and dump off, you know, injectable sterile water. So Kamen went, what if I could turn tap water into injectable water, make dialysis patients a life a lot easier? And he started doing it. And, you know, and he figured out different ways to do it. And when he finally found the right way to do it, it required a lot of energy. So he went back and he revised a version of the Stirling engine from the 18th century and created a version that can run on anything. You can run it on cow dung if you want. And put it all together and created an invention called the slingshot that can literally take anything wet, salt water, latrine water, arsenic-laden water, and turn it into injectable-grade drinking water for less than 0.0, I think it's less than half a cent a gallon at this point, and less energy than it takes to run a hairdryer. And that's where we are today. And this technology, he's tested it out. It's gone through two rounds of testing. It is now being backed by Coca-Cola, who has the largest kind of distribution network in the world. So they can get it everywhere that there's a water shortage, and they can be the supply chain for maintenance problems. So Kamen and Coca-Cola and the slingshot, you know, bodes very, 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 very well for issues of water shortages.
And we'll be wise enough to take the long view, and because it also seems that human beings have this tendency to exploit the environment to death, and because we don't really think very well about the future. We're pretty much all bound up in now. It seems like that they also have, in addition to maybe changing and adopting new technologies, we have to have new ways of thinking.
Yeah, we talk about this a little bit in the book. Obviously, we wrote the book to change people's mindset, but mostly we wanted people to know what was now possible and why they would have difficulty believing in it, you know, kind of what's the neuroscience and psychology that surrounds it. But we do talk about what you're talking about a little bit going forward, and, you know, it's a critical point. It's not, you know, something we dive deep into, and it's probably a topic for the next book, but it's there.
Yeah. Well, we're just about the point we have to finish. I guess I find myself wanting to figure out what everything is wrong with what you have to say, which I suppose, again, goes back to your point about that human beings have this kind of orientation, that we're really rather primed to look for the things that are wrong and to try to find the flaws in any argument or look for the threat that lurks around the corner.
It is unfortunately how, you know, how our brain is wired, and, you know, we evolved the brain, you know, our brain evolved at a time when danger was, you know, of the immediate variety, and it forced us to have the short view. And, you know, right now, and there's a lot of good movement. I mean, Stuart Brand's Long Now Foundation, a lot of people are starting to say, hey, we need to not just kind of stretch out our view temporarily. We also have to. One of the great things that's happening, you know, now in the past 2 years, is conservation organizations, major conservation organizations, are starting to talk to each other for the first time because everybody's starting to realize that hey, these problems are linked, and there's new ways to solve them, and we need to start talking to each other. And so it's not just like we need to have the long view. We also need to get the researchers talking to one another, because a lot of the secret leverage that Peter and I found, you know, the experts have a hard time with it because it sits between fields. So one of the reasons that not getting talked about, because it's in blind spots. Technologists are seeing it, but it hasn't kind of penetrated through academia yet.
Well, folks can take a look at the book and look at the ideas in there and see what they think. The title of the book is Abundance: The Future is Better Than You Think. It is published by Free Press, co-authored by Peter Diamandis. He's the chairman and CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation, and our guest, Steve Kotler. His work has appeared in a number of places: New York Times Magazine, Wired, Discover, Popular Science, GQ, Outside. He also writes a regular blog for psychologytoday.com. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue. So please stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy. Support for WILL is provided by Risk Management Commodities, presenting an Agricultural Outlook meeting at Trails Banquet Facility in Lafayette, Indiana, on Thursday, July 12th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tom Fritz from EFG in Chicago will be there. More information is available at 866-837-9027.
Heading into the final hours of today's futures trading session, grain and soybeans remain lower as open outcry, market participants are taking profits and pairing their risk ahead of tomorrow's USDA reports that will include inventory forecasts for corn, soybeans, and wheat. The average trade guess for corn yields at 154.1 and U.S. ending stocks for new crop corn of 840 million bushels. Meanwhile, the ending stock, for new crop ending stocks, 1.232 billion bushels. Meanwhile, over on the soybean side of the equation, USDA looking to update its numbers. The trade's got the yield at 42.3 and new crop ending stocks of 134 million bushels. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars in the trading pit. In Kansas City, we're seeing that July wheat is at 815 down 2.5. July wheat in Chicago is 806 and 3 quarters down 4. July corn, 763 and a quarter down 12. December, 720 and a half down 9.5. July of 13 at 728 down 8 and 3 quarters. July soybeans, 1667 and a quarter